Hi, everybody. Welcome to Buzzing About Romance. I am Leah, and on this episode, I'm giving you a quick shot of romance, but author spotlight edition. And on this spotlight, I am joined by debut author Edward Schmidt. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Leah. Thank you for having me.
Edward Schmidt is an author based in New York City. From theater kid to graphic designer to creative director, he is always exploring new ways to tell stories. A passionate mental health advocate, he's worked in the nonprofit space for over 7 years. The Open Era is his debut novel and combines three things close to his heart: queer love stories, mental health awareness, and the most beautiful sport in the world, tennis.
Why did you laugh at that part?
Well, because
are we disagreeing already?
Well, I enjoy tennis. I mean, it's better than golf.
That's, yeah. Well, yeah, I don't want to anger anyone. Like, also, I should say this is my very first podcast, so I don't want to say anything controversial and say, like, golf
isn't. You can say whatever you want.
Like, golf is beautiful. Every sport is beautiful, but tennis is especially beautiful.
I enjoy tennis, but I enjoy more of a I'm going to, like, maul you into the ground or into the boards type of sport because apparently I...
Like physical contact.
Yes. Like, it's like the anger, like, is all laid out. And
yeah,
tennis, yeah. There's... The grunting gets to me sometimes.
The grunting gets to you in, like, I'm annoyed way?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like I get it. It's a lot of exertion. I can play it. Somewhat. Maybe that's part of it too, is I'm not very good at it and it makes me grumpy.
I think that anyone playing tennis, even at the top level, is upset with their performance of playing tennis.
Like,
that's
I'm sure.
Part of the game.
Yeah.
I certainly feel that way. I picked it up a few years ago and I'm always upset with myself about my performance on the court. There's always room for improvement.
My sister-in-law played tennis in high school because she's like, I needed something to do. And so my youngest, she swims and she's like, she does it begrudgingly. And I'm like, you could try tennis. She's like, I don't think I want to do that. I'm like, okay. Because like I said, I enjoy it. It's just not one of my top 10.
Yeah. 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 Oh, you have top 10 in sports?
Well, I probably not because I don't really watch
I want you to name 10 sports as quickly as you can.
Well, hockey, baseball, football, soccer, rugby, golf, tennis, dance, swim, dive.
I would have, that's really good. I would have gotten stuck on that question. I grew up I was a theater kid growing up, as you read in my bio, and yeah. I did not care about sports whatsoever. It's very, very wild that I wrote a sports romance. But now I'm obsessed with tennis.
Well, that's not a bad thing. So, like, when I was growing up, I danced. I played basketball, which that's another one I didn't name. I played basketball.
Now we softball. Have 11 sports. It's 11 of them. This is LA Olympics.
But, like, my brother he golfed. He played baseball. He played basketball. So we were at a lot of sporting things. Like, Sports Center was, like, our morning wake up.
Sure.
So sports was always a big thing in my house growing up.
I like it.
Yeah. But before we talk about the Open Era, let's get to know you a little bit more because we've just dived right in. So what made you write this book?
A few years ago, I was looking for outlets to work on my mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And a great way to do that is to just get outside and work on your physical health too.
Yeah.
And that was really never a huge priority for me. As I said, I was a theater kid growing up. I was, just doing shows, musicals, plays for all of my life and did not care about sports.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to I've lived in New York City for a long time now. And I went to the US Open every single year just for the vibes though, just for like the $24 honey deuces. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. But one year I just caught myself really getting into the matches and, I was like, well, I like watching tennis. I'm going to start playing it. So I took lessons. I took clinics. I found like random strangers online to hit with.
Yeah.
And I became obsessed with the sport because I loved playing it. You're kind of like each time you get out there on the court and you hit like a great shot, it feels so great.
It's
and of course
that,
it's
like endorphin hit.
Oh,
yeah.
It's like watching a great video on like Instagram or TikTok and you scroll looking for like the next great one too.
Uh-huh.
And of course they're net, like you hit a thousand other terrible shots after that.
Yeah.
But you're
of
still
course.
Chasing that
right.
next one. And that was it was just like everything about tennis was very exciting to me, and it became my entire personality, unfortunately, for my friends. I started watching it more on TV. I was reading anything that I could. I was watching any movie that was tennis related. And I started looking for openly gay players to watch and support. Okay. And there are a few openly gay women on tour, and there have been since Billie Jean King. But at the time, there were zero openly gay men playing at the top level in tennis. And I wanted to know why that was. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get that question out of my head. And it turned into a novel. What would it be like to be the first openly gay man to compete in a Grand Slam?
Well, and I mean, that's kind of a theme throughout male sports, because you figure if you follow any like women's professional sport, which they don't get the notoriety that they should, but there often are openly gay women in every sport across the board. And men, it's a whole other world.
Yeah. Yeah. And we are slowly seeing progress across like other major sports. Even in tennis, in the past 1 to 2 years, we've had two players come out. Mm-hmm. And that's been amazing to see. One of them is from Brazil, and he played qualifiers in US Open last year. And I was just refreshing the schedule to see like when that match would actually be, because that's a pretty historic moment for tennis. This book is about the first openly gay male tennis player to compete in like the main draw of a Grand Slam, but he made history competing in qualifiers. Mm-hmm. So I was at that match. I rushed there. It was amazing to be there, and I can't wait to see more from him.
Well, and to be a part of that moment must be just like watching it must have been like wonderful.
It was wonderful for many reasons. It's just as just supporting him at that match and being there with it's seemingly other queer fans who were there to support, and also like seeing a piece of the book become reality in a way was kind of surreal. It was a great night at the US Open. I've had many great nights at the US Open.
Oh, I'm sure. So here's a question. What is your favorite musical?
Pippin is my favorite musical.
Really?
Yes.
Why Pippin?
I think that it was one of my first introductions to musicals and in theater. I saw it pretty young. It was in a theater in Charleston, South Carolina. And I love a coming of age story. Mm-hmm. And that is what Pippin is. Like you start with like Corner of the Sky, and like that's what we're all trying to reach for and claim. And I love the journey that Pippin goes on of like reaching for the stars and finding something more important and more meaningful than the stars family.
That's a great one.
But what's your take on Pippin? Why was that a shocking answer?
It just isn't the go-to for most people. I enjoy Pippin because so my high school, like we did the musicals and I was always a big part of those. Like I did a lot of the art, like the backdrops and things with that, because I was an art kid also. But then I like was in the musicals, but like and my brother and my sister were both in them. My brother actually, like he was the lead in a lot of them when he was in high school. And it's just Pippin is just one of those ones that it's not always the go-to.
It was revived on Broadway a few years ago, and they the theme that I don't know if you saw it, but like they did like a circus theme around it. Like that was
take,
and it was a very big spectacle. It was just a cool revival.
It's so neat.
I like other musicals too, though. Let me find a more popular one to say. This is not a musical, but I really loved, I saw Oh Mary.
I've heard that is wonderful.
A few months ago. And that is laugh out loud, smart, funny, a great time.
Yeah, I have heard such good things about that one. I unfortunately have not been to a show in a very long time. I think I was in college the last time I went to a musical. One of my friends and I had, like, we did season passes to the Benedum. And it was like when Wicked first came to Pittsburgh, and we saw that, and we saw Cats, and I think we saw a couple other things. Like, Cats is one of those musicals, like, you love to hate it.
Yeah, It's still like in the end, it's fun to watch the cats
It
dance.
is, but there's just something about it. You're like, oh man, I don't know if I like this, but you do like it at the same time, but then you don't want to admit that you like it.
Oh, Mr. Mistopheles.
So are you a big reader also?
Yes, I am. And that started like in third grade. I had a really great I don't know what language arts, what was it called in
It was just
elementary
English
school? I don't
back then. Well, I'm not
I
sure how
don't
old you are, but like when I was in third grade, it was just English.
I don't remember what that class was called, but the teacher's name was Miss Witt,
Okay.
and she instilled a love of reading in me. I think that my favorite, like, we read Hatchet, and like there was a book called Shiloh, and then two sequels that followed. And I don't know, I fell in love with those stories. And like, she had the classroom design so cool. Like, it was pretty, like, it wasn't lit very well, I guess, for reading. My eyesight is still fine, but like, it was just very cozy. And it was amazing. And it was a really great, she's just like really opened my eyes to the power of story, and helped me find books that I really liked. And also, like, my entire family are big readers. My two grandparents on my mom's side are librarians, or were librarians, and had a deep love for libraries, as we all should. And so it's just, and they died a few years ago, and they had no idea I would ever write a book. They supported me in like my short films that I made, and like on stage, but like I didn't have huge ambitions to ever write a novel. And they would be freaking out right now about all of this, like, to be published by Penguin Random House and be talking to you right now. Like, it'd be amazing for them.
Well, I mean, it's nice to have that support system, though, no matter what you're doing, because not everybody has that.
I'm very, very lucky. I have a wonderful family, and they're extremely supportive.
So, when you were writing your book, did you plan it out from start to finish and kind of outline it, or as you were writing, you just kind of let the words and the characters speak to you?
It's a little bit of both, but I do like to know where we're going. I knew the beginning, middle, and the end. And then like, it's tough in between, because like, you wake up one day, and I write in the mornings, and like, you'll complete a scene, and you're like, well, I know where we're going. I don't know how to get there though. So that was a lot of figuring things out. And for this book, I was taking a course from Curtis Brown Creative, which is there's Curtis Brown the agency, and they have a creative side that teaches courses. And this is my first time writing a book, and I wanted to make sure I was doing it well. With that course, like, we were submitting like 3,000 words at a time to the other students in the course, and getting feedback constantly. And then when that course ended, I had a critique group, and we were trading pages all the time. So someone was always like directly behind me, like giving feedback. And that was an interesting way of doing this, because you get feedback almost in real time, and you can make adjustments. But yeah, to answer your question specifically, I like to know where we're going. And that is, I made tons of discoveries just writing it, where I just tried something out, and I'm like, oh shit, I think that works. Can I say shit here?
You can say anything you
Cool.
want.
Anything. So yeah, and that's always a fun process, and I like to leave room for surprise.
I tell every author that I do these interviews with, like, I love these are my favorite thing to do for the podcast because point A to point B, the journey is so different, but the end result is the same. Like, everybody has a different way that they write and a different style they write and a different method they write. Like, we were talking to an author and she was saying that she just kind of lets it flow, but she will write out of order. I have an author who I'm friends with, and we refer to her as the Kelly Chaos because she is all over the place and like writes everything out of order and like moves stuff like, and it's just so fascinating to me, like how there's so many different ways to write a book, and I love it.
I fear that I'm kind of boring about it because, like, I do like to know where we're going, and I do not write out of order.
No.
I mean, maybe one day I will, but I'm working on my second book right now, and it's in order. I like one scene to directly
to
inform,
next.
And I mm-hmm. want to make sure the transition is.
I mean, if it works
seamless-ish.
For you, it works for you.
Yeah, but it's tough because, like, you are excited to write, like, a certain scene, and I get the temptation to mm-hmm. like go off and do that, but, like, I know that I need that scene to be informed by exactly what happened before that and what came before that. So I see it quite linearly right now.
It's a tough word to say.
It's a tough word for 9:49 a.m.
It is, yeah. I mean, early mornings are always the worst. There are some words that are just really hard to say no matter what.
I'm second guessing if linearly is a word. It doesn't even sound real anymore. Is it? It is, right?
I mean, if you could put it on a Scrabble board.
Yeah.
I think you can.
Yeah, that'd get you some points.
We played Scrabble recently and I challenged a word and I was wrong and I was mad.
In Scrabble, if you challenge a word.
You lose your next turn.
Oh, no.
And it was my 12-year-old who put the word down. And I was got to be kidding me.
You second-guessed your 12-year-old.
I did. She's a smarty, though. But I was.
What was the word? Do you remember the word?
No, I don't even remember.
Was it linearly?
No, it wasn't that. What was it? No, I can't remember. That's going to bug me.
Who normally wins when you play Scrabble with your 12-year-old?
It kind of goes hand in hand. It really, because you figure Scrabble's, there's intelligence, but there's strategy and chance because it depends on what tiles you pull. Like my oldest, he is 15 and he had the Z, but he could not, no, he had the Q and he couldn't figure out how to play it.
Yeah.
So he was real mad. He did not win and he was a little angry.
Next time.
Yeah. Games get a little intense in my house. Like a game of Sorry is real bad.
I mean, yeah, we started off talking about how you like the brutality of sports. So I wonder how that translates to Scrabble.
I am the competitive one in the family. Like my husband played football, he threw in track and all those things, but he is not competitive. Like he does not really get into it. He's just like, whatever. But that is not me. Like it gets intense sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to enjoy it. And if that's what makes you enjoy mm-hmm. it, great.
Exactly. We cancel each other out. Like it's a good flow.
Yeah.
So The Open Era comes out June 2nd, 2026. It is your debut. It is a tennis book, but the mental health rep in this book and the way that you treated it and the anxiety aspects and the therapy aspects, like I love that because I think therapy, anxiety, all the mental health stuff, it's such a taboo subject still. Even now in 2026, which makes me very angry. But I am such a big advocate. Like, I think everybody should go to therapy at least once in their life.
Thank you for saying all of that. And it really is a big piece mm-hmm. of the book. So the main character, his name is Austin Hardy. He's 20 years old and he has generalized anxiety disorder and mm-hmm. it stands directly in his way of winning the US Open, and it also stands in his way of like having like a relationship
a little bit. General. Yeah. It affects them all.
Yeah. And he is pretty reluctant about therapy mm-hmm. At the start, and we do see him having his first therapy session and like what's that like, and the thoughts that go inside your head when you're kind of like sizing up your therapist and mm-hmm. I'm like, who are you, how can you help me, and do I even need help? He does need help, spoiler alert, he needs some help like we all do. Mm-hmm. And I'm a huge proponent of therapy. It's helped me a lot in my life. And like it's also imperfect too. And Austin picks up on that. It's not going to solve all of your problems, but I think that it's tough when you're not saying these things out loud.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as the book progresses, like we see that he still like balks at it. He still pushes back. He still has a hard time really embracing it because he doesn't want to really dive deep into why the anxiety is manifesting the way it is.
Yeah. I wanted it to be realistic mm-hmm. there because healing and improving your mental health. It's not easy, and it takes time. This mm-hmm. book takes place over 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That's it. And I designed it that way. I wanted it to be a pressure cooker of a scenario where a lot of shit is going down over 2 weeks. A lot of it. And he cannot solve all of his problems in 2 weeks, but he can take, there can still be growth in an arc, and he can take steps in the right direction. And he has a huge career ahead of him, and he has a lot of work to do to help himself get through it.
Well, and I think one of the things in the book too, the way you have it played out, like him being the first openly gay player, there's a lot of social media, like interaction, not so much interaction, but the negative sides of it and how it can create this downward mental spiral for a lot of people, and how like when you separate that helps, but it's just always lingering in the back of your head. And it's like social media is great, but social media is also terrible at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, half of his problems would go away if there was no social media. Like he does an interview after he qualifies for the U.S. Open, and the interviewer asks him, like, he just acknowledges that he's making history, and like asks him to comment about it. And he's been out since high school. It really it wasn't a big deal, but it's but he's still kind of surprised by the question. Like, he didn't see it coming, and that interview goes viral, and that's sort of like his big coming out party to the world. And it sets off sort of a chain of events. It's how his love interest, Diego, kind of encounters him for the first time. And it's social media has done some wonderful things. It's brought a lot of people together. It helps people discover great art. It helps us find community, but it is quite difficult on mental health, and especially for younger people who don't have the self-control and like the protections that they might need to help themselves.
It's a slippery slope for so many people. But so in Austin's world, he has his mom, he has his sister, he has his coach, and they're all very supportive of all the choices that he makes and the direction that he's going. But they are very worried about him too. And I think that the way that that storyline played out, it was such a valid thing, because it's like they want him to succeed. They want him to do these things, but they're like, but not at the cost of yourself. And I think that's such a huge like part of the story too. And like it, not everybody has that either. It's like you hear so many like horror stories about like kid athletes who have coaches that just push and push and push. And it's like, then they don't like it anymore. Like kids are like, you have to, I mean, and at 20, you're still pretty much a kid. And it's like, you fall out of love with those types of things because you don't have the right style of support behind you.
Austin's coach, his name is Robbie. He was best friends with Austin's dad, and Austin's dad passes away a few years before the book starts, and Robbie feels this extreme sense of responsibility to protect him. And Robbie was a former pro player, and he kind of like comes out of retirement, so to speak, to coach Austin, and he's been his coach ever since juniors. But yeah, there is. It's tough for Robbie because like he's a great coach and Austin is a really great player, and that's Austin's dream, is to become the best player in the world. But Robbie can help him get there, but he also sees the cost. He literally like playing out in Austin's health, his mental health, and he has to reckon with that. And this is a story told first person straight through Austin's point of view. So we don't get an extreme like window into Robbie's head, but like we get glimpses of how difficult this is for him, and it's very complicated.
So what made you decide to keep it just in Austin's point of view?
That was never ever a question for me. Like, I want you locked in on Austin. I want you inside of his brain, and I want you to feel what it's like to live with anxiety and to be on the court and to fall in love. And when you're falling in love or you have a crush on someone, you're always like, you're just, when it's new, even when it's old, you're like, do they really like me? Like, do they, I don't know. I think I see their behavior. I think they do, but I don't know. And Austin really gets in his head about it. And, but if I gave you Diego chapters, that tension goes away. You know what Diego's thinking. I want you to live as this person for 368 pages. And yeah, just lock you in.
When I'm reading, I oftentimes, like, I don't always love a book when it's told from a singular point of view. I feel like sometimes you need that other person's. But I think with Austin's book, like this book with Open Era, like the mental health journey and like the way in which Austin spirals so much throughout the book, I think that having those other chapters in a different point of view, no matter whose it would have been, would have pulled you out of that, like, headspace for it. Like, because he's a soft character, but he's not a soft character at the same time. And I think adding a different style of character in it would have like messed with the flow. So I think that, like I said, I don't typically like it, but every once in a while I'll come across a book where it's like, I don't think I needed it. But then I think with this one though, I don't think we want to know Diego's headspace through a lot of the book, which I'm not going to really talk about that because that spoils it. But I think having his, it would have hurt the story.
Yeah, it was never a question for me. I think Diego is an extremely interesting character, and I certainly could have written double the amount of the book if we wanted to see what was going on in his life more closely. But yeah, I really wanted to put you on a roller coaster in one seat for 2 weeks, the US Open, and you get it through Austin.
So for the book, I assume that you've done research and the, like, how the US Open, like the training schedules, the timing schedules, because there's like I said, I watch tennis every once in a while, but I do not understand the intricacies of the background. But it's like they have hitting partners and like the schedules and the different courts and all those things. Like, how was it researching all of that?
It was so much. At the beginning, it was research that I didn't realize was research because there were lots of things that I was doing that I think were setting myself up for success here because I had been going to the US Open for many years. I started playing tennis, so like not anywhere close to that level, but like I know what the feeling is like to hit a ball and to curse yourself out when you perform poorly. Like, you can extrapolate those feelings. And I was reading books on players. One of my favorite is Andre Agassi's Open. Really wonderful, excellently written book. And my dad is also obsessed with tennis. He also found it relatively later in life. And he is retired now, but he's a chair umpire for college matches. So he's like watching it and like living it a lot. So I had lots of questions, like small little detail questions for him. He also has a good friend who's a former pro player who's played at the US Open. Who I had direct access to. I had a slight in. And there's also a lot of great media around tennis now. There's a docuseries that Netflix did that shows you a lot of behind the scenes. Players are very generous with what they show on social media. So like all of those things combined like built this world inside my brain that I just had to translate onto the page.
I mean, not knowing anything aside from the ball goes back and forth. Because honestly, one thing I love about watching tennis is when they go to the crowd and their heads just move back and forth.
Yeah.
It's like that is.
The trick is to sit behind the baseline so you don't have to move your head.
There you go.
And there you go.
I don't know. Like golf, like you're following a little white ball, like
Right. It's
around a
just like
giant
one like
field.
head move every once in a while when they hit
And it's
it.
like, and then you have to kind of look up and all
Yeah.
those things. But
Yeah.
tennis, like
It's
there's
a
a.
slow motion tennis, like neck pan. Let's go.
Well, in tennis, like it could, like those volleys can get fast, like
Yeah.
because I mean, speed of serve is like a big thing. It's like fat,
Yeah.
like the speed of a pitch in baseball, like the speed of a serve, and like how fast you can serve that ball. Like it's something. But not really understanding tennis. I mean, I felt very like enveloped into the sport itself. Like you definitely make it. Like you're right in like the thick of it with all of it.
Yeah, I wanted you to feel that way. Yeah, it's strap in for 2 weeks of epic gay tennis at the US Open.
And one of the, so in the story though too, Austin, so like we get his story, like he has dropped out of college to go after this goal of his. And I mean, like I said, I don't really follow tennis, but I can imagine like how difficult that decision would have been, like to play at a high school or a college level. And he was like, well, I was on the team, but I was better than all of them. So it was difficult. And it's like, but is that a normal thing for people to go to college or just go straight into it? Because the juniors like scene is such a big thing in tennis. And so I guess I never really thought of tennis players going to college.
Yeah, I just saw an article about it's I think it was called like the disappearing college tennis athlete where more and more are electing to go pro versus going to school. And I think one of the more recent examples is Ben Shelton, who was going to school and dropped out, I think a year later. Because like if you're good enough to go pro, you do it. I think is the reasoning right now. But you're and I think one of Robbie's issues with that, Austin's coach, is like you're missing out on that college experience. Like you go straight to career and you don't get to develop yourself as a person and make all the
Dumb college
mistakes.
decision.
The dumb college decisions that you can make safely in that environment and you learn about yourself, versus straight to tour, traveling 11 out of 12 months, it's growing up very fast. And Austin still has a whole lot of growing up to do.
He does, and but I think that you really portrayed him like you have him like this multi-layer person where he is mature in some ways, very immature in other ways, but still in a lot of ways trying to figure out like who he is as an individual and not like part of his family, but also like him as an individual in the tennis world, but personally as well.
He, I mean, he's like you said, he's 20 years old. He's a kid.
Frontal
And
lobe
like,
has not fully formed yet.
right. And we're stuck with that for 360 pages. He has a lot of growing up to do, and you see that happen on the page. And yeah, it's also about like discovering yourself too in the public eye. He needs some media training. Like he kind of does whatever he wants for these interviews, and then creates a bit of a scene, and then like guarantees that he gets more questions that poke at that later on. He's sometimes his own worst enemy. But yeah, he also re there's a scene. A chapter early on where he encounters a younger fan who really looks up to him, and
It really
Austin.
takes him like a second, and I think it really catches him off guard that it occurred.
Cause he's pissed that he's not getting questions about his athleticism and like how his performance, and instead the media is focused on asking him about his sexuality, and that he doesn't like that. But then he sees the other side of the coin where like he is becoming this role model whether he wants to or not, and with that comes a lot of responsibility, as a quote from Spider-Man I think addresses with a great forehand power. comes lots of responsibility.
So what is next for you? Or are you allowed to talk about it? Because I know with trad stuff, sometimes you can, sometimes you can't.
I can say this. I am working on a second book. You will see it in 2027. It is unrelated to the open era, but it is also a queer romance summer adventure.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your morning and stopping by and chatting.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great. Thanks, Leah.
And until next time, happy reading, everybody.
Find us on Instagram at Buzzing About Romance or on Twitter at Buzzing Romance. If you like the podcast, please leave a review. If you'd like to support us directly, join the Bookcase and Coffee Patreon and receive exclusive content only available to Patreon members. Check out bookcaseandcoffee.com for our on-the-shelf show notes.